case, Ganton Technologies versus International Union et al. Mr. Badzak?
May it please the court, this case involves an arbitrator who exceeded his authority under a labor contract by modifying the terms of the contract rather than interpreting them.
Wasn't that modification, as you would term it, really simply a mistake? He overlooked one clause in the contract, what he did.
Well, he ignored that one clause, which was the only clause in the contract that defined the term company, which was the central issue with respect to Article 15, Section 8 that he determined.
And was that clause, was that particular provision brought to his attention squarely during the arbitration?
Yes, it was, Judge.
How was it?
There was
his attention squarely.
There was the labor agreement was presented to him as an exhibit at the arbitration hearing, and there was specific.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that wasn't a very long document either, was it?
No, it was not.
How many pages is it about, do you think?
I'd have to look back
Don't worry about it.
But there was also specific testimony on that provision from the witnesses at the hearing about the fact that the term company was defined as Ganton Technology.
So the only place that you really fell down maybe a little bit was in the pre-hearing brief, post-hearing brief, is that correct?
That's correct.
Apparently was not made.
That's correct, Judge. And the case law on this subject requires that the parties are required to submit information, evidence to the arbitrator in order to permit him to make an informed decision. And the company did that here. And there's no question, based on his award, that he determined that was an issue. He knew what the company's position was on it. He simply disregarded the only provision in the contract that defined the term company.
Is it really so clear that the agreement defines company to mean Ganton? I mean, as I read the agreement, it defines company to mean the two facilities in Racine, and that gives rise to an ambiguity or uncertainty once we get to the transfer provision, because the agreement doesn't specify which the other facilities are covered by the transfer provision.
Well, what the language says, Intermet Racine Plant and Intermet Racine Machining of Wisconsin, formerly Ganton Technologies, hereinafter referred to as the company. And even if you look at the district court decision, Judge Randa concluded that the language of the agreement in that provision did expressly define the term company to mean Ganton Technologies.
Is there anything in the agreement that draws a distinction between Ganton as the subsidiary and Intermet as the parent?
Well, the agreement itself does not reference Intermet as the parent. And there was, on that subject, there was also testimony and information that was presented to the arbitrator on the purchase and the nature of the purchase and the fact that Ganton was a separate entity.
Okay, speaking of the arbitrator, if the agreement so clearly defines the company to mean Ganton and not Intermet, then why wasn't that Ganton's first and last argument to the arbitrator?
Here's why. The issue that the union presented in their grievance was a claim that the company had transferred work in violation of the agreement. And at the hearing, there was evidence presented on behalf of the company that showed that there were no transfers of work anywhere, and also that the only work that was transferred was outsourced to third parties, which is something that even the arbitrator acknowledges and the union acknowledges is expressly permitted under the contract. In response, the union presented evidence which they said supported their argument that there was some transfer of work, and they presented a die list that showed some tools that were transferred from Racine to the Tennessee facility. And there was also testimony by one of the union witnesses that he was, quote, 80% sure that there was work that was transferred. So at the end of the day, there was no evidence that work was transferred anywhere, regardless where it was transferred, other than this outsourcing. So the focus on the question of what the definition of company was not the primary issue that was addressed in Intermet's Intermet post-hearing.
Well, Ms. Babcock, did you submit anything other than the text on this issue?
In terms of submissions to the arbitrator, in addition to the text, there was testimony at the hearing.
Well, you had
on that.
You submitted in the briefs about relevant terms, right?
That's
but
right.
But you chose not to make the company one of the relevant terms to discuss.
Again, because there was no evidence that there was work that was transferred anywhere outside of the Racine facilities other than this outsourcing work, that wasn't a key issue that we felt needed to be addressed in the post-hearing briefs. It was addressed at the hearing. Clearly, the arbitrator knew what our position was on that issue, but because of the way the evidence was presented at the hearing, it was not something that we believed needed to be focused upon in the post-hearing briefs.
But how can the arbitrator be faulted for ignoring what you say is the clear definition of the term company when you didn't cite that, as Judge Flom just noted, as one of the relevant contract provisions?
Well, again, that issue was brought up during the hearing itself, but because of the way the evidence came out at the hearing, we didn't believe that was something that needed to be addressed in the post-hearing briefs. And these are labor arbitrations. It's not like a jury trial, and it's intended to be something that's much more expeditious and resolved more quickly and less expensively for the parties. And if there's a requirement that after an arbitration hearing, someone must submit a post-hearing brief which addresses every piece of evidence that was raised during the hearing in order to avoid waiver of issues, then that imposes an onerous burden on the parties to these arbitrations, and that's not appropriate.
What's the onerous burden? For you not to present, never alert the arbitrator to the importance of how the company is defined?
Well,
is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying we did alert him to the importance of how the company is defined, but there could be any myriad of ways that he could have come out with his decision afterwards and focused on other issues, and to say that because the post-hearing brief did not address everything that was covered at the hearing, or repeat everything that was covered at the hearing, does not constitute a waiver. And I'm not aware of any case law that says you must repeatedly raise an issue or raise an argument in an arbitration in order to preserve that argument. That issue was raised with him. It's undisputed that it was raised with him at the hearing.
So, in other words, Ganton alerted the arbitrator to the importance of how the company is defined.
That's right. That's correct.
But the definition of company wasn't your first argument to the arbitrator.
That's correct, Judge.
You want to reserve some time? All right. Thank you, Ms. Kondizek. Ms. Graff?
May it please the Court. George Graff, representing the unions. Let me first, if I may, deal with some of the questions that the court asked counsel. He says that the issue was brought to the attention of the arbitrator. Well, in a sense, that's true. As shown in their Appendix 42, company counsel asked the union representative, who's the company? And the union representative said, Intermet. That's on page 116 and 117 of the Appendix 42. And then when they when they finished with the arbitration and they filed their briefs, the company, every time they opened their mouth, indicated they were representing Intermet. They never, of course, as the court has indicated, they never mentioned this clause again, never, ever. And they said, interesting to note, in our Appendix 6 in our brief, the company counsel in his brief even points out that he understands that the question was work transferred to any other Intermet-owned facility. That's his wording. That's Appendix 6 in our brief. Everything they did, if they raised the issue for the arbitrator, had to lead the arbitrator to the conclusion they were abandoning that argument. They were no longer thinking that was a viable argument. And, you know, this circuit has been pretty tough on waivers. He says he don't know of any case where the court has said you have to argue something in order to preserve it. Well, he might want to look at Dean and the Butler cases. Those, the court in Dean, I mean, and I've got it quoted to you about 8 or 9 times in the brief, but the point is that the court said you've got to argue it, and if you don't argue it, it's waived.
Talking about this circuit's case law, as you did a moment ago, on the main issue before us, are the requisite deference to the arbitrator. Do you understand our case law to be in the heartland of cases in the United States, or have we taken a fairly idiosyncratic route with respect to those?
Well, I think your decisions are in the main line. I may disagree with some individual decisions where, you know, I think there's a way out of the general rule. But no, I think that the rule is very clear, and that is if there is some reasonable or rational basis for the arbitrator's decision, it should be sustained.
Do you think our cases can live in peace with the cases from the Fourth and the Eighth Circuit, or do you think those are cases...
The ones that are cited?
Yes, please.
Oh, yes, I think so.
I appreciate your view on that.
Yeah, you're talking about that Clinchfield case and the Hormel case.
Please.
Well, and let me address it in the context of our case here.
That would be helpful.
You know, in both of those cases, the clauses that were ignored, and the court did find that ignoring essential clauses vitiated the arbitrator's award. The clauses that were ignored were the issues that were set right before the arbitrator. In other words, they were the clauses they were fighting over. As distinguished from here, even counsel has said it was a secondary issue. So I think in your case, Anheuser-Busch, you know, I don't know if I agree with that, but if you take the case, clearly the issue before the court was the clause that we were talking about, and then when that was not addressed, the court took the position
that
the arbitrator...
So there was stronger evidence, if you want, that the arbitrator in those cases had simply said, to heck with these clauses, I'm going to do what I want.
Right.
But in our cases...
In your cases, and in particularly in this case...
In this case, we don't have that, is your point. Right?
That's right.
Yes.
If you read his award, and I think it's pages 8 to 11 of his award, if you read his award, he did a very nice job of addressing what was put before him. Article 15, Section 8, the subcontracting clause, he looked at what they had proposed at the bargaining table, he looked at the testimony of each side, he then looked at the language, and he came to the conclusion that when you look at the word company in there, it means internet. And, you know, unless, you know, there are a number of cases, I've had some of them myself, where if an arbitrator has given you a very rational and analytical analysis of the arguments that were put forth, the court normally says that shows that his decision comes from the essence of the contract. And here, there's really no doubt about it. If you look at the way he wrote the award, he was a very careful award. But they say, oh, throw that out because of one thing. He didn't mention this clause, which is not the essential clause in here, and we haven't argued it, but throw it out because of that. And I think if you read your cases, you know, they're very clear that you do give deference to the arbitration awards, as the Supreme Court says you must.
Well, they're clear on that. The reason I ask the question is I think there's a good deal of hyperbole, I suppose, in some of the language we've used. It makes it sound like, you know, this is a rubber stamp operation. That's what I'm concerned about.
Well, I think the court has made it clear it's not a rubber stamp operation. I think in some cases that I would think you should have rubber stamped, you found differently.
Does one come to mind as you...
Pardon?
Does one come to mind?
Well, I'd rather not mention it. A young radiator, Judge Flom recognizes that case. But that was different. The arbitrator made comments about things which were clearly outside the contract. Yes, that case comes to mind definitely. The other point I'd like to really deal with just real quickly is he says all you got to do is submit the information to the arbitrator and then we fulfill our duty. I think that's really nonsense. And the district court, I think, felt the same way. If I put a piece of evidence out there, how in the world is the arbitrator supposed to figure out whether that's something that is very meaningful or that you want me to, the arbitrator to deal with? And in this case, it almost went to the point of they misled him. They asked some questions about this language. They abandoned it. Then on their brief, and their two briefs, they go away from it completely. And if I were the arbitrator reading that, I would think they've abandoned that issue. And how can I say that? How can they say that they fulfilled their duty to the arbitrator by simply putting a couple questions in on the issue, ma'am? Well, I thought you had a question.
I'm trying to think of what you were talking
about. So we would base our argument on two things. Number one, if you look at the general law, which Judge Ripple has been talking about, I think this award certainly meets that test. You have a rational analysis of the case. He is relying on the contract. He is relying on the issue that the parties put before him. And, you know, he clearly is not going off on some tangent. Secondly, I think this argument that they're making has no validity whatsoever, and if it did, they've waived it in their conduct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graff. Mr. Bannerdine.
Just to address a few points raised by Mr. Graff. First of all, with respect to the cases from this circuit that deal with waiver, those cases are distinguishable from this one. In each of those cases, the court pointed out, you didn't raise this issue at all with the arbitrators. You didn't raise it during the hearing. You didn't raise it anywhere. And that's the thing that distinguishes this case from those, is that this issue was something that was raised with the arbitrator. And the suggestion that the arbitrator was misled into believing that that wasn't an issue, obviously, at the end of the day, he decided it was an issue and he knew what the company's position was on it because he addressed it in his arbitration award. So that does not constitute a waiver under the case law from this circuit. And I believe that in response to Judge Ripple's question about the consistency between case law from this circuit and other circuits, I think the case law from this circuit is consistent with other circuits, including the case from the Fourth Circuit that we cited in our materials, because this circuit, just like other circuits, has concluded that where an arbitrator disregards specific language in the contract in arriving at his decision, the decision or the award does not draw its essence from the labor agreement. And a couple examples of those cases are the Tootsie Roll Industries case, 832 F. 2nd, 81, where the court indicated that the labor arbitrator failed to follow the clear requirements of the agreement, and therefore it was appropriate to vacate the award. Likewise, in the Anheuser-Busch case, which was mentioned, it's 280 F. 3rd, 1133, this court in that case concluded that it was appropriate to vacate the award, again, because the arbitrator had disregarded the language of it. And so I do think that there is a basis here under this circuit's case law for vacating this award, and that's what the court should do in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Bannerdine. Thank you, Mr. Graff. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.